We're doing Ein Yaakov, and we're about to learn a very difficult, counterintuitive piece of Talmud. The words are easy. The concepts are difficult to absorb. And so before we learn this, I'd like to introduce what we're about to learn. Okay? When we approach the Tanakh, so there are multiple ways to read Tanakh. You could read Tanakh and say, got it. It's a good story. I understood every word. You could read Tanakh and say, there's a tradition here. These words weren't written so simply. I have to glean from the wisdom from those that have a tradition in order to understand what's written here. Our approach is the latter. The Talmud tells us about Rav Kahana. Rav Kahana, does anyone know who Rav Kahana was? I'm not talking about the Rabbi Kahana who passed away a few years ago. Rav Kahana in the Talmud. So the answer is there were three Rav Kahanas. When you read Rav Kahana in the Talmud, you always have to ask, which one is it? There was one who lived during the beginning of the era of the Talmud, the beginning of the Amoraic period. There was one who lived in the middle and one who lived in the end. So there were at least three Rav Kahanas in Jewish history, and they have different halachic weights. The early Rav Kahana has halachic weight almost as though he were a Tana, almost as though he were a rabbi from the Mishnah period. He has a tremendous halachic weight. So Rav Kahana tells us that he had mastered all of the Torah. He learned all of Tanakh, all of Mishnah, all of Talmud, and reviewed it. And he learned again and again and again, and then he stumbled upon the following concept. En mikra yotze midei pshuto. That the verse also has its literal meaning. Meaning all the time that he learned, he thought the only meaning the verse has is our traditional meaning. And after a period that he had already mastered the Torah, he learned this new concept that there is also the literal meaning of the text. Okay? So that's not the way we approach Tanakh. We think, I read it, I understood it. Rav Kahana, after everything he learned, knew that the major component of understanding of Tanakh, of the Bible, lies in tradition. Only later on in his life did he discover there is also value to the literal meaning of the text. That teaches us something. Our approach to Tanakh should be based in tradition. And if I'm going to just take a translated JPS Bible and start reading the translation, I can be very far off. Because the literal meaning of the words is very far from our tradition. The Torah says an eye for an eye. And no one in Jewish tradition believes you should do an eye for an eye. Okay? So that's a text says very clearly what it says. And our tradition is that it is not to be taken literally. So there you have one example. We have many examples. You read Tanakh and you discover many examples where our tradition says that's not what you think it is. It says, where totafot, what is totafot? Totafot is? Oh, so the Mishnah in Tractate Shabbos tells us, yotze'a isha betotefet. A woman may go out into public domain with totafot. She can wear tefillin on Shabbos? No. Totafot was a piece of jewelry that women wore on their forehead. So what does the Torah say? Where do we wear totafot? Where do we wear that ornament? What does it say in the Torah? Bein einecha, between your eyes. So we should all be walking around with tefillin right here, smack in the middle. That's what it says. Never seen a Jew do that, right? A Karaite might do that because they don't have tradition. Our tradition is that it corresponds to the middle between your eyes, but you don't wear tefillin between your eyes. So we have many examples. All of Jewish life is filled with this concept. It says on Shabbos, Al yetzei ish mimekomo bayom hashevi'i. Don't leave your place on the seventh day. So then comes Shabbos, we should all be glued to our seats. That's what it says, don't leave your place. Better get a good position, right? A good recliner or something. You're going to be spending the next 24 hours that way. But what does the text say? If I'm going to go with the literal text, then I have many texts that really give me a different direction. It says about tzitzis, Uri'item oto, you should see them. So the Karaites used to hang tzitzis all around their house. In ancient times, the Karaites is an evolving movement. They keep changing what they believe. But there were times where they'd hang tzitzis around the house. Let's see, what other examples do we have? There are a few more, but for now, let's move on. So we have this concept that Torah can only be understood with tradition. In our mind, our tradition is that when the Torah was given at Sinai, it was given intertwined, the written and the oral law. How many Torahs were the Jews given? Two, the written Torah and the oral Torah. Okay, should we go off on a small tangent? It's an important tangent. Yeah, let's go off on a small tangent. Okay, there's a very important medrash called Psikta de Rav Kahana. It is one of the earliest midrashim we have. And in that medrash it says the following. God knew, God foresaw, obviously God knows without seeing, God knew that a time would come when nations would claim that they are the chosen people. The medrash says that Hashem said, I know that nations will translate the Bible and say, we are the chosen people. We can read Bible too. And Hashem said, in order to ensure that no one can claim they are the chosen people, I will make the Bible only understood through the oral law, and I will make the oral law so complex and intricate that you can't understand it without tradition. So you open up Talmud and you start learning and you say, I don't get it. And this seems to be so out of order. And you got to learn so much till you start understanding anything. And the answer is, you got that right. Talmud was purposely written in a way in which you could not master it unless you had a teacher who learned from a teacher, etc. And the Medrash says that Hashem purposely made the oral law so that no nation can copy it. And that's what we discover. That the nations that took the Torah and said, we will apply it, and we got it, they developed societies which look at themselves and say, this doesn't seem right. And they can never get that balanced life that Judaism gives us. You can try and say, we will be more observant than the Jews. We will cut off the hand of a person that steals. The Torah speaks about cutting off a hand, right? The Torah says, v'katzota et kapa, cut off the woman's hand if she does something, right? You know, Torah discusses, two men are fighting, the woman intervenes, she sticks her hand in the wrong place. Cut off her hand, says the Torah. We don't cut off a woman's hand. Our tradition is that you don't do that. You'll never see a Jewish court cutting off a woman's hand. But you'll see other courts cutting off people's hands in the names of the Bible. I don't want to go into who. So we have a situation where Hashem says, I'll give you the oral law and I'll give you the written law. And the written law cannot be understood correctly, and you'll never get a balanced life out of the written law unless you work with the oral law. So that says the Medrash, was the way Hashem ensured that no nation could really compete with us. There will be nations who will take the written law, but then when they try to apply it, they'll end up hitting dead ends. It won't work right. And so that's the gift Hashem gave us. Now you understand why the oral law is so complex. It's difficult. It's hard. You don't get it in the beginning. But what we're about to study, this piece in the Ein Yaakov, is an example of oral tradition telling you the text is not to be taken literally. I know you read it and you thought it meant one way. Well, that's also true when the Torah says an eye for an eye and cutting off her hand and sitting down on Shabbos and not budging. There are a lot of lines in Tanakh which, if taken literally, have a totally different meaning. Let's take the wonderful story of the binding. So we have a father and his 37-year-old son, and the son asks him, Dad, I don't see any goats. And the father says, well, God told me that if no goat appears, then I'm supposed to sacrifice you. And the son says, I'm with you, Dad. If that's what God said, I'm perfectly willing to do it. And even though Isaac was a powerful young man, he was 37 years old, his father was an old man, he acquiesces. And then he says, Dad, I want you to tie me because I might flinch. And if I flinch, then I'm going to mess up everything. But do me a favor, Dad. We have a whole tradition as to the conversations that went on there. Yitzchak tells Avram, how are you going to tell Mom about this? We have a tradition about the conversation. We have a tradition about Abraham's tears. Avram's crying as he approaches the altar. Yitzchak saying, "Dad, tie me tight, because if I flinch, I'm human. And when I see the knife approaching, I'm going to jump, and I don't want to jump you. So do me a favor, tie me down." Ah, but you look at the text, that's not what it says. So our tradition has a whole conversation. We have pages that describe what happened there. We don't have the time now. Yet you open the text, and what does it say? The text certainly reads like the old man conned the little boy. The old man tied the little boy. And then you read the text, and wow, what a vicious story. Well, again, you try to approach the Torah without tradition, you'll get a totally different Torah. So that's an intro to our story. Our portion of Talmud, where we're holding an Ein Yaakov, is discussing two stories. Two stories that are portrayed in very harsh terms. And if read literally, then the stories certainly throw the book at the characters. We have the story of Reuven. And the Torah clearly says he slept with his father's wife. Okay, the Torah said it. But then again, the Torah said a lot of other things. The Torah told us the story of binding of Isaac. And the Torah didn't bother telling us that Isaac was 37 years old. You need tradition, and then you could piece it together from the verses. The Torah doesn't say that Isaac said, "Tie me so I don't flinch." The oral tradition says that. You come to the story, again, I gave examples in the beginning of class, many examples. The Torah doesn't say, put the tefillin where you still have hair growing, those of you who still have hair growing, right? Imagine I did, right? Torah doesn't say, put it above your hairline. Torah says, between your eyes, left it to the oral tradition. And so we have instances in Torah where the Torah purposely worded something in a manner so that the literal text gives a certain connotation. One of those is the story of Reuven, where the Torah throws the book at him. Next is the story of Eli's sons. So in Prophets we will learn there was a high priest. His name was Eli. Just after the period of the judges, possibly he was the last or the second to last judge. Right after the book of Judges, we have the book of Samuel, Shmuel. And the man who is raising Shmuel is the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, Eli. And Eli has two sons, Hophni and Pinchas. And it says Hophni and Pinchas were very ill behaved. They would take meat and they would say, "I'm not interested in waiting for the sacrifice." And they ran the temple by force. And then the Navi describes they would sleep with the women who came up to bring their sacrifices. Now that sounds terrible. It is, if that's what happened. Our tradition says that's not what happened. That the Navi purposely worded it that way. The Navi for eternity wrote it in a way that was damning, purposely to blame them. But our tradition is that that's not literally what happened. Just like with Reuven, our tradition is that that's not literally what happened. So too with the sons of Eli. Amar Rav Shmuel ben Nachmani, Amar Rav Yonatan. Our Talmud begins with a quote in the name of Rabbi Yonatan. Kol haomer b'nei Eli chateu eino ela toeh. All who say that the sons of Eli transgressed are none other than in error. You think that's what it means? You're making a mistake. Shenema. As the verse says, V'sham shnei bnei Eli, Hophni u'Pinchas, kohanim l'Hashem. The verse describes them as priests to Hashem. Why does the verse describe them that way? The verse should have said, and there at the temple were two wicked people, two con artists, two people who got dressed up as servants of Hashem and abused their powers, and we hate them forever because they were wicked people. No, the Navi introduces them as two men of God. And then the Navi says they sinned. So he says, you want to understand Tanakh, you have to know how to read the Tanakh. If the Tanakh introduces them as men of God and then tells you what their transgression was, and the transgression is a heinous crime, a crime that you should give up your life rather than commit, right? Adultery, you have to give up your life. It's one of the mitzvot you have to give up your life for, right? So you're telling me they're men of God, but they're doing the worst sin on earth, almost, you know, one of the worst three. That doesn't fit. Ah, comes the tradition and says, okay, it's not to be taken literally. That's why they are described as men of God. Savar la kerav. Damar Rav Pinchas lochata. Rav says, we have a tradition that of the two brothers, Pinchas did not transgress. Makish chofni le Pinchas. And the Pasuk says the two, the Pasuk equates the two to tell you, ma Pinchas lochata af chofni lochata, that just like Pinchas didn't sin, neither did chofni. Elamani mekayem. But wait a second, says the Talmud. What about the text? The text does say, asher yishkevun et anashim. They slept with the women. What does it mean? So the Talmud says, no, no, no. Slept with the women, you assume it means they had intimate relations with the women. That's not what it means. It means that the women would come to bring their sacrifices. And Chofni and Pinchas took their time. They were enjoying the meat. And then the women would say, you know, I'm supposed to bring a sacrifice today. And they'd slaughter the animal. And then the women would say, I can't leave till I see that you've taken care of the animal. And Chofni and Pinchas would take their time. And what would happen is that all these women who flocked to bring their sacrifices after they'd give birth to a child would end up spending the night on the temple grounds. So when the Chofni and Pinchas went to sleep, all around them were women waiting for them to do their duties. So they were sleeping with the women. But it doesn't mean literally they were being intimate with the women. It means they caused the temple to be looked down upon. People would say, you know, we come up here to get real service. You're supposed to be our representatives before God. And instead of being quick to do your service, you're enjoying the meats. And then instead of the wives coming home to their husbands and running the families, you'd come up to the temple and on any given night, you'd see flocks of women sleeping all around the temple because they were waiting for their sacrifice to be brought. That's not so nice. But it's a far cry from committing adultery. So the Talmud says, our tradition is that although the text says they slept with the women, the text did not mean to say they were intimate with them. Mitoch sheshahuit kinehen, being that they delayed their sacrifice of the birds, shelo alchu etzel ba'alehen, and so the women didn't go back home to their husbands. The husbands would wait, and instead of it being a 5-10 minute thing, you come up there, you bring the sacrifice, I saw you did it, I could go back home. Instead, it would take a whole night. They'd wait there the whole night till it was done. Maleh lehem ha-katuv kiru shachvum, and the Pasuk purposely worded it as though they slept with the women, because God was saying, that's how disgraceful their behavior was. In my eyes, it's as though they did that. So, you ask me literally what happened? No, there was no intimacy going on. You ask me how grave was their transgression? When people come up and they expect real service, you're representing God over here. God gave you this responsibility. And people look at it and see you enjoying the meat and detaining everyone because you want to enjoy the meat. It says that it's like they slept with them. So,
is it the same case?
So with Reuven and his father's wife, we started discussing it last semester. Our sages say he didn't literally sleep with her, but the Pasuk purposely words it that way because, again, Hashem held it very badly against him that he interfered in matters of intimacy. Either sleeping in the tent or moving his father's bed. He got involved where he had no right to get involved.
Okay.
Yes? Sometimes. The word lishkav could also be intimacy. Yeah. The word lishkav can mean. The Rambam says the reason that Hebrew is called Lashon HaKodesh is because there is no direct word for intimate things. It will always be a euphemism. We say tashmish amita, use of the bed. Lishkav, to sleep with. Yada, to know. All the terms in Tanakh are terms that are euphemisms. Yes?
Can you just say a few words about why is it that we had before this conclusion of fact that they didn't mean to make it accessible for the rest of the world? It was supposed to be that you could only learn with a teacher, right? So I'm asking myself, why is that? I mean, on one hand, you know that Torah is, you know, maybe there is.
Yaakov, I'm sorry to cut you off. You came in the middle, and it was explained before you walked in. Yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry. If you ask anyone here, they'll all be able to explain to you. We're in the middle of a thought here. I just want to throw at you a point to ponder. We read this in Talmud, and it seems like Chafni and Pinchas were very bad, right? You read the story and you say, gee, that's tough. So I'll ask you a question. Imagine you're the Kohen. Imagine it's your job every day to bring other people sacrifices. Imagine you're a doctor. Imagine you're a local Orthodox rabbi. And every time you want to sit down and have dinner with your family, there's a knock on the door. And the phone rings. And SMSs come in, and people have questions. Wouldn't you at some point say, I have to eat dinner with my family? I'm saying, we look at this story, and we look at Chafni and Pinchas and say, what are you guys doing enjoying the meat while all these women are waiting? But I'm asking you, how many nights would you be able to go and leave your families every time another woman comes up? You say, sorry, I got to go deal with the woman. I'll be back in 10 minutes. How many nights would you hold out eating dinner and having to stop to go and deal? Every time you have a meal, they're calling you and you never eat like a normal human being. Think about it. There's a story that Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, who were two of the great luminaries of the previous generation, they both came to a dinner and they had been busy dealing with public affairs, so they showed up late to the dinner. And there was a person in the middle of a speech, so they reached the door to the auditorium where everyone was sitting, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said to Rav Moshe Feinstein, let's wait till the speech ends, and then we'll go join our wives, because if we walk in now in the middle of the speech, everyone will stand up, and it's not nice in the middle of a speech, everyone stands up. So Rav Moshe Feinstein said to Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, let's go in now. So he said, why? He said, our wives are up there. And how many times do our wives have to stop dinner for us to answer a phone call, answer the door? How many times do they get their private life taken away from them because we were there to help the public? They deserve that good feeling to see how the whole auditorium stands up when we walk in. Let's give them that good feeling. They deserve it. Because they're the ones that suffer the brunt of it when we do the service for the public. So let them have that feeling. And then they walked in and they met. The speech stopped for a second. Everyone stood up and they went and they took their seats. I'm just saying it's something to think about. We learn about Chafni and Pinchas and we get riled up. You know, you're men of God. You should be there for the public. Would we be able to be there? You could be there one night. You could be there a week. You could be there a month. But when this is your life, you know how many times doctors' wives have to stop and people come knocking at their door and you go out, you're on a plane and suddenly you hear, is there a doctor on the plane, right? How many times do they lose their husbands to public service? So before we judge Chafni and Pinchas, we have to ask ourselves a little bit, would we be able to do any better?